Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Irma after Harvey, DACA dumped, Trump makes a deal with Democrats, Donald Trump Jr. questioned on Russia, a giant data breach, and North Korea claims to have the hydrogen bomb. Florida Governor Rick Scott says Hurricane Irma could be even more catastrophic than the record breaker that hit the region 25 years ago.
Remember, Hurricane Andrew is one of the worst storms in the history of Florida. This storm is much worse and more devastating on its current path.
Protests broke out across the country as Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced a rollback of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program.
The program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
And U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, had harsh words for North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un after a missile test this week.
His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Josh Gerstein of Politico, Nancy Cordes of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you fleeing Florida? What should happen with DACA? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Josh Gerstein, senior White House reporter for Politico, also covers the Justice Department and courts. Josh, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom, good to be with you again.
Also with us from Washington, the one and only Nancy Cordes, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News. It's Nancy. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be back with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Josh.
There was Harvey, and now here's Irma, and once again, records falling. Here's meteorologist Tom Sater on Wednesday saying, Irma, now the strongest storm ever recorded in the Atlantic, by some measures, ever in the world.
Irma is now the strongest hurricane to ever plow into the Leeward Islands. Yesterday, we mentioned only Hurricane Allen from 1980 was stronger in recorded history for the Atlantic by 5 miles per hour. Irma today, however, has surpassed Allen by continuing to churn for over 24 hours with winds above 180. Allen never did that.
And we've seen over 185 miles an hour for longer than any other storm anywhere ever on the planet. Miami resident Carlos Torres told ITV News yesterday he expects the worst when Hurricane Irma hits South Florida. He and his family, they're out.
I've been saying for a long time, one of these days is going to happen, and I think this one could be the one. So we're not taking any risk and we're leaving.
Nancy Cordes, you're an island girl, long way from Florida, but a Hawaiian island girl. What do you think of what you see on the weather charts? And none of us here are meteorologists, but you can just look at these charts and it's kind of jaw-dropping.
Right. And I think it's no joke when they tell people that they need to get to shelters or they need to evacuate. You know, it's all well and good to think that you can ride it out. But I have been in a house during a hurricane on the ground floor when the top floor blew off. And that is a frightening experience that I remember every minute of, even though I was only 8 years old when it happened in Hurricane Eva, you know, which was nowhere near the strength of the hurricane that we're talking about now. So, you know, my advice to anyone in the hurricane's path is, you know, if you feel like riding it out at home and you're being told otherwise, but you can't get out of town, just get to a shelter. Just get to somewhere where you can be safe during the storm. And then you can go right back and assess the damage. But, don't put yourself in harm's way.
Be alive. Hurricane Irma now downgraded to Category 4, but still packing an incredible punch. And Josh Gerstein, we look at the anticipated path. And of course, this could change. But as it's anticipated right now, it is plowing directly into the Florida Peninsula, you know, expected to go right up Florida, right up into Georgia and beyond. I mean, I don't know if in your family or friends, everybody seems to have somebody in Florida right now that they're worried about or trying to get out or definitely on their mind, Josh.
Yeah, I have parents and a brother, a father who I spoke to just earlier in the day, who is making final preparations to go inland. And I think you're right to point out how it may go right up the center of Florida, or even maybe even worse if it goes right along the East Coast and basically goes over all the major inhabited metropolises there in South Florida. Mm-hmm. We're looking at real trouble. Remember, Andrew, I think, was over the peninsula, over inhabited areas anyway, for maybe only like 4 hours. And they're saying that if this one goes straight up the state, it could linger over the state for 24 hours, which could result in really sort of unprecedented devastation.
Jack, I mean, many people will remember Andrew and those images of block after block, mile after mile, it felt like, of houses just looked like they had exploded. Nancy says, you know, just take the roof right off. And indeed, it did in many instances. And now you've got the governor of Florida saying, expect worse.
Expect worse. And to look back at Andrew, most of the damage then was by wind. And people fear now that water, rising seas, could be a problem, because since Andrew, water around Miami's coasts have gone up about 3.3 inches. So there's a higher level of water that could, you know, add a touch of Houston, a touch of Harvey to Irma, and maybe even more than a touch. It's a looming catastrophe.
Nancy, we just have had Congress dealing with what it's going to cost to rebuild and recover on the Texas coast, Houston, and a wide span beyond. Is Congress now looking at this one and saying, oh boy, here comes another big tab for recovery right behind?
Yes. And by the way, they're well aware that the money that they are funneling towards Houston is just a down payment. We're talking about $15 billion in emergency relief funds just to get people, you know, sheltered, get them food and water, to deal with some of the immediate problems. But they're well aware that Houston itself is going to need tens of billions of dollars more. And then, you know, now you're looking at the devastation from Irma. So what they needed to do this week was just keep FEMA solvent, because there was a concern that FEMA would run out of money as early as this weekend. They've gotten better at getting that money out the door, but what that means is that there's, you know, less money to work with very quickly. This is going to be something that comes up again and again for Congress this year. Remember, Hurricane Sandy ended up requiring Congress to pass a $50 billion relief package. And now we're looking at two storms that could have even more damage.
Let's go to Nate calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, thanks for calling. You're on the air. You're a long way from Florida. What's on your mind when it comes to the storm, Nate?
I do have an uncle down there who I think is bunkering down in his house rather than moving out like they're advising people should. Though I hope he stays safe. I also think that both the governor of Texas and Florida have been doing their people a disservice by basically trying to cover up what they can about global warming, and now it's going to hit people.
I mean, there's no question it's coming right at people, and these superlatives attached to this, the record-breaking aspects of this, Josh, are getting people's attention now. The conversation about climate change has gone back and forth, people debating. I mean, say what you like, we've got record breakers here, back-to-back, each in their own way, and the country paying the price.
Well, and even right now, back-to-back, right? I mean, there's three different hurricane-size storms coming in on the Atlantic, and there may be another one, Hurricane Jose, right in behind Irma. So it does seem to a layperson like these things are happening with greater frequency and greater intensity. I lack the sort of scientific skills to tell you whether you can tie these things to climate change or how you tie them to climate change. But I will say, having some family in the Miami Beach area, there's no question they have been struggling with higher and higher sea levels, sometimes for mysterious reasons, and having a lot of difficulties there pumping the water out on the more and more frequent basis that it ends up, waterlogging their streets and neighborhoods.
I mean, the scientists say there's not a lot of mystery about it. The sea level rise and climate change very much attached. Terry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Are Donald Trump and the other deniers going to fly down to Florida and stand in the face of this storm and prove that it's a Chinese hoax? Are they going to protect people from it with their personalities?
I don't think a personality is going to buffer this one. I mean, Nancy, do you hear in the halls of Congress a changing tone? People just saying, no, it's weather. We just got a couple of big ones stacked up here. So what? Or scratching their heads, especially when the bill comes due. That makes it very real and saying, well, maybe, yes, here we go. We got a problem.
I don't hear anything new from Republicans on that front. And if anything, from Democrats, I hear more reluctance to use the words climate change. In fact, in a press conference this week, Nancy Pelosi said, well, we can't say climate change, you know, but we'll just talk about, you know.
And what's the point with that?
Frequent storms. The point is that it is such a bone of contention between Democrats and Republicans that sometimes inserting it into discussions mm-hmm. of hurricane relief only makes things more difficult. And so while I don't think that Democrats are backing off in any way from their belief that climate change is what is causing more frequent and more intense storms, they realize that there is not much value in bringing it up in this context, which, you know, is kind of troubling to a lot of them because, you know, they feel that this is a real life threat. Sometimes, many people believe it's the biggest threat to this country in the long and to the world in the long term. And it disturbs them that they can't seem to speak frankly about it.
Jack Media, are we going to drown debating?
While we're even talking about the terms of the debate. Yes, you have to be candid. I mean, the grip of the Koch brothers, the grip of the oil lobby, the connection between our campaigns and that money. I mean, where effectively these, if you probably went up to these Republicans and said, what do you really think? They'd say, of course there's climate change. I can't say that, though, and get elected and get the campaign funds I need. So in a strange way, I think Bernie Sanders is right when he says again and again, our problems come back to a corrupt politics.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news there. The sound of wind and heavy rain behind us from Hurricane Irma in St. Martin. Caribbean island devastated by the storm. Beachfront airport there destroyed and much, much more. Nancy Cordes is with us, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News. Josh Gerstein, senior White House reporter for Politico. Jack Beatty is here and you can join us. What are you thinking on these back-to-back storms? On DACA and the Dreamers and what Congress may now do? On President Trump doing a deal with the Democrats as Mitch McConnell looked pretty darned unhappy there this week. For that matter, this Equifax data breach, 140, nearly 45 million Americans' personal records now out there, cyber attack. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Price tag for these hurricanes hitting, record-setting hurricanes, going to be big. Here's Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott talking with Fox News about what Hurricane Harvey may cost.
When you look at the number of homes and businesses affected by this, I think this will cost well over $120 billion, probably $150 to $180 billion.
They'll be coming to Washington for that. A small down payment this week. Much more to come. These storms are costly. Linda in Tampa, Florida. Hi, Linda. You're on the air. Thank you for calling. What do you see?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make the point that in Tampa, after just an everyday kind of storm that we get here, we have flooded streets, closed streets, and that's just on an everyday rain. And our roads are so antiquated, and I think it's because we have a Republican governor who refuses to tax, you know, raise taxes, especially on the wealthy. And every day, if you're coming from Sarasota back to Tampa and you have to go across the Howard Franklin, across the bay, you are sitting in a parking lot. I mean, our roads are like bumper to bumper on a good day. It's like it's 2017 and we're living in the dark ages.
Linda, the governor says that this storm's so big it could hit both coasts of Florida, the east and the west coast. You're there on the west coast. Are you leaving? Are people leaving? Are they hunkering down?
Well, at some point we're leaving, and at the next day we're staying. And the latest forecast is that it's going to be a Category 2. so we're staying. We live in a fairly new home with shutters on every window and everything, so if it stays a Category 2, we're staying.
We wish you and everybody there in Florida the very best, and take care. Keep an eye on all of that, Linda, and I appreciate your call. We're going to be watching the storm as we talk in this hour, but of course there's a lot that's going on here. DACA going down this week. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was sent out to announce it, the thing being rescinded. Here he was in his Tuesday press conference announcing the end of the program that President Obama had implemented by executive order in 2012. Said it was an unconstitutional overreach.
The executive branch, through DACA, deliberately sought to achieve what the legislative branch specifically refused to authorize on multiple occasions. Such an open-ended circumvention of immigration laws was an unconstitutional exercise of authority by the executive branch.
Josh Kirstein, you cover the White House and Department of Justice. Donald Trump campaigned on ending this as he ran for president. Why was it Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, sent out to make the announcement?
Well, I think that the president was very ambivalent about making this decision, and they felt that it was best to lay it off, essentially, on the attorney general and on the legalities of the situation. I mean, both Attorney General Sessions and the president during the presidential campaign said repeatedly not only that they didn't like this DACA program as part of a broader issue about how the country has handled immigration policy, but they said it was illegal. And so there was a tension there. We've been asking, I've been asking at the Justice Department for 10 months, you know, what is the legal basis for continuing to renew people's DACA status if this program is illegal? What's been done with the Obama administration official memos that remain on the books, legal policy for the U.S. government that says that this program is legal? And we never got a straight answer. And they began to rectify that on Tuesday. I think the president clearly was very uncomfortable with being the face of an action that many people immediately blasted as sort of cruel and unnecessary. There really wasn't any real deadline this week to deal with this issue. There were threats of litigation from red states, but there was no hammer that was going to be brought down this week that would have thrown the program into chaos.
The whole thing now thrown over to Congress to do something about it. The president tweeting this week, Congress now has 6 months to legalize DACA. And he went on to say, if they can't, I will revisit this issue. Now, if this is executive overreach, if it's unconstitutional, then how could Donald Trump revisit the issue, Josh?
Well, that is a very good question. And he issued that tweet at the end of the day when there was already a lot of news coverage of DACA recipients, so-called dreamers, many of them students, saying that they were terrified that they were going to be deported. It did seem like a bizarre message for the president to send out. Because A, the attorney general had said this was unconstitutional, but B, the strategy seemed to be to put pressure on Congress to deal with this and resolve it in the next 6 months. How you put pressure on them and then also tell them, by the way, if you can't get it done like you so often can't with many contentious issues, I'll try to figure out how to fix it from here. It just seemed like a bizarre and highly ambivalent approach.
It looked like mixed signals, even though the attorney general was saying it was flatly unconstitutional. On Wednesday, here was President Trump, though, on Air Force One saying, no mixed signal here.
No mixed signal at all. Congress, I really believe, wants to take care of the situation. I really believe it. Even very conservative members of Congress, I've seen it firsthand. If they don't, we're going to see what we're going to do.
See what we're going to do. Nancy Cordes, you cover Congress. The president believes they really want to take care of this situation. Is that how it looks to you?
Yes, leaders say they do want to take care of the situation, but as we've seen time and time again on Capitol Hill, wanting to get something passed and being able to get it passed are two different things. So, there are a lot of people who are in limbo and feel nervous for good reason. The Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, said this week that he hopes that Congress can find consensus. He didn't say, I'm confident Congress can find consensus. He said he hopes that they can. And while the notion of protecting these young people who were brought to the country illegally is broadly popular throughout the country, and members of Congress know that, you also have Republicans who are not going to be willing to just straight up pass something like the DREAM Act on its own without some border security measures attached to it, to be able to say, yes, we believe that the DREAM Act may inspire other people to try to do the same thing, bring their kids here. But we've also imposed some border security measures to prevent that from happening. That's something that Democrats, by and large, are comfortable with. But where does the rubber meet the road? What kinds of border security measures are we talking about? If it's more border patrol agents, something like that, you know, that's going to have a lot of support. If you're talking about billions of dollars for a new wall, that is going to be a big bone of contention. And Democrats have said that that's a non-starter. At the end of the day, if that's what they have to swallow in order to get the Dream Act, you know, they might change their minds. But things are still very much in flux right now. Republicans were hoping that they'd be able to focus on tax reform this fall. And now instead, they're also looking at what historically has been one of the most contentious issues on Capitol Hill, immigration. And they've been able to make no headway on immigration in recent years.
It did sound earlier this week as though the White House may indeed kind of hold the Dreamers hostage for funding for the wall. Here was the White House briefing on Tuesday. Jim Acosta, CNN, asked Sarah Huckabee Sanders whether or not allowing DACA recipients to remain in the U.S. was a bargaining chip when it comes to funding the border wall.
It sounds like the president is saying, and you're saying, that if we're going to allow the Dreamers to stay in this country, we want a wall. Is that accurate?
I don't think that the president's been shy about the fact that he wants a wall, and certainly something that he feels is an important part of a responsible immigration reform package.
Josh Christian, you're covering the White House. Is that why the president's kind of got the Cheshire Cat smile this week? He thinks he's found his leverage for border wall funding in the Dreamers?
I think some people in the White House may believe that that's part of the way this deal can be done. I don't think the president is actually that excited about this controversy over the Dreamers. He's been very skittish about it. Remember, after being put up to it, apparently, by Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, he sent another tweet later in the week saying that the Dreamers basically have nothing to worry about. So I don't think it's part of some grand package that the president thinks he could get through that he's eager to move. That said, the White House has framed it that way. The staffers there do believe that this can be put together with border security, with other things like the wall funding, and moved as some sort of package. Whether that's really feasible, I don't know. The people on the left and the immigration advocates are saying they don't want any security money here, and they're particularly nervous that this is somehow going to be used for ICE enforcement within the United States. And so people who currently have DACA status in exchange for keeping it would basically be putting more agents on the street, they say, to deport their parents and other relatives, and they're not willing to make that kind of a deal.
Jack Beatty, what do you see fundamentally going on with DACA being thrown out this week? You heard, like we all did, Jeff Sessions saying unconstitutional. But this is a lot of young people who came here not on their own volition, grew up here in American schools trying to make plans and live here. Sessions said, we need these jobs for Americans, but you've got a lot of American employers saying, really opposing this and saying, we need these people. Even this week on the Texas coast, you've heard contractors saying, I don't have enough labor here to rebuild from Hurricane Harvey. What's fundamentally going on with this move, Jack?
It seems to be something that comes out of Trump's, I will have no enemies to my right on ethno-nationalist issues. I mean, Jeff Sessions has a beachhead in the Oval Office in the shape of Mr. Miller, the president's chief domestic advisor, and this is very much the Sessions policy of conviction about this. I mean, Jeff Sessions and Miller too, I guess, see the chicken plucking plants in Alabama and point to that and say that's what the Dreamers. Well, of course, Dreamers don't work there. In order to be a Dreamer, you've got to be a high school graduate. You've got to have this, that, and the other thing. That's a different problem entirely. But the president just simply can't make enemies on that side. I think we saw some of that in Charlottesville, and we see it again and again. He just seems to want to hold on to these most passionate supporters, even in areas where he has convictions on the other side. He leans that way.
Hilton Head, South Carolina, on the coast there. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I don't understand why everybody's down on Trump. I mean, the people that founded our Constitution and country did not give the power to make the law to one person. It's to the people. And the people are represented by Congress. So if the people want DACA to be upheld and the Dreamers protected, then the people have to do it. It's not for one man to say yes or no. And I think that's what Trump is saying, that Congress has to decide if that's what the people of the United States want.
Nancy Curtis, what do you say to John? I mean, there it is. You want it? Go to Congress and get it.
I think John makes an excellent point, but recall that the only reason that President Obama took action in the first place, and he was not that excited about having to do it, was because Congress couldn't seem to do anything. And time again, we've seen that Congress appears to be more gridlocked than probably you are, John, with your neighbors when you're talking about the most sensible ways to work through issues. And so for years, Congress was faced with this problem, couldn't seem to get anything done. And in the end, President Obama took action, you know, that he admitted was not a perfect solution. And certainly it infuriated Republicans. So now you've got President Trump returning that responsibility to Congress, and on one hand, giving them some motivation by saying, okay, you've got 6 months to do this, and nothing fires up Congress like a deadline. But on the other hand, he's also saying, and if you don't do it, I'm going to revisit it. So sort of, you know, removing the stick at the same time that he puts it there. And so there's a lot of confusion on Capitol Hill about what that mean. So would he actually take it up again? And how can he take it up again if he's just said that what President Obama did was unconstitutional? Mm. So, you know, that's sort of the murky situation that we find ourselves in right now.
John, may I ask you, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen here. Maybe Congress will put it through as law and that will settle that. But if they fail to, if they get tangled up and they don't do it, they can't do it. If you were president, I mean, just on the you know, 800,000 young people here, you know, and of course it's going to be good, bad, and ugly, but they've all, to be a dreamer, you can't have a criminal record. You know, they've all sort of come through the school system and they've been promised something. If you were president, John, just on the basis, would you say, back you go to the country you haven't been where you were 2 years, 800,000, back they go. Would you do that?
But Tom, where does the slope start? I mean, if I decide to make law myself, to say the Dreamers stay, then I can make law about anything else I want to do.
I get it, but it's now in. So you'd say go. You kids out. That's what you would do, flat, just on the basis of
I would say it's the people's. If the people want them to stay, then the people have to make that choice. It's not the choice of one person. Now, I can, you know, to revisit it, quote unquote, you know, as Truman, I can come in with a heavy stick and, you know, kind of force some congressmen to get off the pot. But I think that it is up to the people to make the decision. You know, if you're saying the president can make a law in this case, then why can't he make a law tomorrow about something else? Why can't he say no smoking at all in the United States? Good health reason.
Yeah, yeah. No, I hear you, but there's that issue of humanity. I mean, I don't know about your family, but I sure had family that came here poor, and well before there was anything like formal documentation, they tumbled in here. And I have fellow feeling for these immigrants, as you know, when I think back on my own who came here penniless and when before there were even immigration restrictions, I just have some fellow feeling right there. Josh Gerstein, how far does that kind of feeling go though on Capitol Hill these days or in Washington?
Well, I think there is a lot of compassion for the Dreamers. It's a very sympathetic situation. Even when I'm going to hearings up there this week, you see people in T-shirts advocating for the Dreamers. Often young people look to me to be in their late teens or early 20s. I should say, though, I do think that this whole issue about who's going to be deported, are we going to force these people out, it's something of a red herring. The real question with the Dreamers is not so much whether they're going to be forced out, because the government doesn't really have the resources to remove them. No one's looking to appropriate the kinds of money to remove those 800,000 people or the 11 million people who are allegedly in the country illegally or without documents from the country. The question is really, under what conditions are they going to stay? Do the Dreamers who are here, can they be enrolled in school? Will they be able to get in-school tuition? Can they get jobs? Do they have to take the money that they get in a legitimate job? Or do they have to take the money they get working under the table? So that's really the issue that they've been struggling with over the last several years and how to deal with the Dreamers.
I I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a major breach of personal data at the credit reporting agency Equifax could impact 143 million Americans. Here's CNBC reporter Aditi Roy.
The sheer number of people who could be potentially affected is what's so striking about this particular attack. I mean, this is like Hurricane Irma-sized proportions affecting U.S. customers.
Late night host Jimmy Kimmel had fun with the Boston Red Sox after they used an Apple Watch to steal signals from the New York Yankees.
Hey, Siri, just tell me what the next pitch is. I'm trying to get a hit.
I found three medical marijuana dispensaries in your area.
Okay, okay. And Walter Becker, co-founder of the 1970s band Steely Dan, has died at 67. Here's the group's 1977 hit, Deacon Blues.
They got a name for the winners in the world. I want a name when I lose. They call Alabama the Crimson Tide. Call me Deacon Blues.
That's been played a few times. We're looking at a week in the news with Josh Gerstein at Politico, Nancy Cordes, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News, and Jack Beatty. Huge hurricanes, DACA out, Trump doing his deal with the Democrats, Don Jr. testifying on Capitol Hill, a giant data breach, North Korea and its hydrogen bomb. It says a huge earthquake in Mexico. You can join us. Are you pulling mom and dad out of Florida this week? Are your eyes just riveted on that Irma image churning across the Atlantic and now up toward Florida? Nancy, we spent a lot of time with Congress, but I have to ask you just a little more here about this deal that the president did with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer this week. He told a crowd in Bismarck, North Dakota here on Wednesday. He had a productive meeting on Wednesday with congressional leaders from both parties. So they agreed to a short-term plan to fund the government and raise its borrowing limit.
We had a great meeting with Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and the whole Republican leadership group. And I'll tell you what, we walked out of there, Mitch and Paul and everybody, Kevin, and we walked out and everybody was happy. Not too happy, because you can never be too happy, but they were happy enough.
Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan happy, Nancy?
I don't know about that. They quickly made it clear that there were no hard feelings. At least they tried to put a positive spin on it. But this was obviously not what they wanted, and Republicans were furious. At the same time, I asked Nancy Pelosi on Thursday, so is this some kind of new renaissance in your relationship, some new era of cooperation with the president? You've said some pretty terrible things about each other over the past few months. And she said, well, I wouldn't call it a renaissance, because that would imply that somehow there was a relationship before that is now being reborn. But she said, look, in certain situations, people who are your opponents on one issue are going to be your allies on others.
Explain
and you always
the
have
deal.
To be on the lookout.
Explain
okay,
the
so,
deal and why Trump did it, Nancy.
So basically what happened was they were all in this room at the White House, and they were trying to figure out what to attach Hurricane Harvey relief funding too. Mm-hmm. And one thing that needs to get done this month, but that is always a contentious issue, especially for Republicans, is raising the debt ceiling. It had to be done by the end of the month. The Treasury Secretary said, you know, that's it. We're running out of our borrowing power. Republicans wanted to raise the debt ceiling for 18 months. They wanted to basically get past the next midterm election. This is always a tough vote for a lot of their conservative members. They didn't want to make them take it again. Democrats, however, wanted to raise the debt ceiling for just 3 months, because then that gives them leverage again 3 months from now. If you want our votes on the debt ceiling, give us A, B, or C, most likely the Dream Act. And so that those were the contours of the argument. They went back and forth. And finally, what the Democrats said was, well, do you have enough votes on your own, Republicans, to raise the debt ceiling? And the answer is no, because there are enough Republicans who believe that you should never raise the debt ceiling without big spending cuts in return. They say that you're failing to confront the debt problem in this country. And, you know, Democrats said, as long as you don't have the votes on your own, we're going to have to go with 3 months. And the president appreciated the logic of that argument. He probably gave in sooner than the Republican leaders would have wanted him to, but it's very possible that they could have gone round and round for another day or so and ended up at the same place, because, you know, the math is what it is, that Republicans may lead Congress, but in this particular situation, they do need Democratic votes.
Now the House has today passed this $15.3 billion in Harvey aid, debt ceiling, government funding. Senate passed it 80-17 on Thursday. You don't hear numbers like that very often lately. Now it goes to the president's desk, of course. Josh Gerstein, there's been speculation here about the president's motivations? Is he still nursing anger over the way other things have or have not worked out with Capitol Hill and Republican leadership there? Is he turning on his own party? How do you interpret what's happening? Or did he just need a deal here?
I think he certainly is still nursing anger about the way things have gone on issues like Obamacare repeal with his own party. You know, in addition to making this deal with the Democrats, he sent out a tweet on Friday morning saying, "Republicans, sorry, I've been hearing about repeal and replace for 7 years and didn't happen." Again, ranting about the filibuster rule in the Senate. But it does seem like he is, I wouldn't call it a strategy because we haven't seen it pursued long enough yet, but at least thinking about a gambit of sort of if you have a quarterback who isn't quite performing, maybe handing the ball to another quarterback. But the problem here is that Schumer and Pelosi are not quarterbacks. You know, they can't run things on Capitol Hill. Things do not happen in the Senate and the House without at least the acquiescence of the House Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader. And so where this strategy goes is unclear. Maybe he sees more flexibility on infrastructure, the president does. We had New York members up there trying to do a big deal for some transportation projects around the city of New York. So maybe he's interested in going in that direction, but where he can find the success on issues like tax reform and infrastructure with Democrats while sort of sidelining or embarrassing Republican leaders on the Hill, many people have been around Washington a long time, don't see how that strategy works for him.
But he was working that thread this week. A Wednesday afternoon, he was out in North Dakota, and he praised North Dakota Democratic U.S. Senator Heidi Heitkamp, who he had brought along with him on Air Force One on that trip, saying he hoped for her support on tax reform. She's seen as vulnerable in her seat there. And here was the president talking in a very supportive way.
Nobody can get anything through Congress. We need support. So thank you, Senator Heitkamp. Everyone's saying, "What's she doing up here?" But I'll tell you what. Good woman, and I think we'll have your support. I hope we'll have your support. And thank you very much, Senator. Thank you for coming up. Senators, thank you. Thank you.
Everybody wondering exactly where this president is going here. Trip in Nashville, Tennessee. Trip, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I was actually calling about Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. I see all the news articles kind of congratulating this move or making it seem as if this is maybe a turning point for Donald Trump, but if on Donald Trump's part, it should have come months ago, and on Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer's part, I think this shows how completely out of touch with the Democratic base they still are.
What do you mean by that exactly, Tripp? What do you mean?
I mean that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are probably two of the least popular members of the Democratic Party when it comes to progressives that supported Bernie Sanders. We're seeing, you know, with Hillary Clinton's book tour and the kind of back and forth that's going on between whether, you know, she backed Bernie's policies or Bernie adopted her policies and made them seem more appealing with the 7 minute, 8 minute abs argument. I just think that this shows that the leadership of the Democratic Party is still in a lot of trouble, and them making deals with the president weeks after Charlottesville is almost unforgivable.
Tripp, I appreciate your call. Let us pick it up here. Jack Beatty, what do you see in this swirling, sometimes strange political alchemy? A president of a very unusual cast, the Democratic leadership looking to make deals, you know, Trip out there watching Hillary on her book tour and right, not happy about any Democrat doing anything with this president. But that what's in this swirl, Jack?
Well, you know, both the president and the Democratic leaders sort of show what politics is all about. It's not about purity. It's not about consistency. It's about, as Mr. Trump says, the deal. And if the Republicans can't govern on an issue, he's triangulating and going with people who can. You know, the criticism I've heard of the Democrats has come from people like Luis Gutierrez, the congressman from Chicago, I believe, who said, why didn't they make approving DACA the basis of this? You know, you want the debt ceiling, you want a budget, then you give us DACA. Along with the answer to that, of course, was given by Dick Durbin, who for 16 years has been working in the Senate for essentially the Dreamers, to get a Dream Act passed. And Senator Dermott said, look, I need 12 Republican votes, and I don't have them now for DACA. So the Gutierrez demand would have been a kind of bootless gesture. But that's the strain of purity in the Democratic Party, or the strain toward it, that some Democratic consultants are just worrying is going to bedevil their chances of winning in 2018.
I don't know if it's purity or just a pleasure in Pelosi and Schumer in sort of getting the better, at least for a moment, of McConnell and Paul Ryan, who had said, do not go down this road. Hearings this week, and the Senate Judiciary Committee talking with Donald Trump Jr. About a meeting with Russians. And do we know what was said there? Was there new ground broken, Josh? Can you speak to it?
Well, I don't think there was a lot of new ground broken. It was a closed-door session, mostly with staffers and with a few senators. What was largely interesting, I think, was the testimony that Donald Trump Jr. gave behind closed doors about this statement that was crafted apparently largely by President Trump aboard Air Force One, trying to, you might say, deflect or shape press attention, public attention, or even investigators' attention from the meeting that was held at Trump Tower with various Russian operatives and agents back during the campaign. Remember, the president helped craft this statement that said this meeting turned out to be was basically focused on adoptions and suggesting that it didn't have anything really to do with gathering dirt on Hillary Clinton. Of course, as we know from the email exchange that Donald Trump Jr. had with another individual who organized the meeting, it was in fact framed as a way to get quote unquote dirt on Hillary Clinton during the campaign. And Donald Trump Jr. admitted in the Senate Judiciary Committee that he was looking to assess what he called Clinton's fitness for office. So investigators are delving into all of that and trying to check out his statements about how this was all crafted and see what other threads they can pursue as they go forward.
Some Democrats coming out of there not happy. This was Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal telling MSNBC yesterday that the Donald Jr. testimony left more questions unanswered than answered in that closed-door meeting, Senate Judiciary Committee.
There were gaping holes in the information that he provided, which is why we need to have him come back in public under oath in a hearing of the Judiciary Committee. But he left nothing to dispel my impression that that June 9th meeting essentially signaled to the Russians, we're open for business, we're ready to deal.
Nancy Cordes, isn't it strange? I mean, the first explanation was all about adoptions and the denial of looking for dirt. And then yesterday, Donald Trump Jr. kind of saying, almost as if it was a good thing to be saying, yes, we were looking for dirt. What happened to yesterday's explanation? I mean, the day before that.
And that's why Democrats want so badly for Don Jr. to have to go before a public hearing in Congress, raise his right hand and swear to tell the truth, and then try to explain his multiple descriptions of what he knew this meeting to be about before it happened and when it happened, because they believe that he is not going to be able to square that circle. And furthermore, they find some of his answers, again yesterday, to sort of strain credulity. For example, the notion that he met with these Russians and then never told his father about it, never brought them to meet his father. And then the next day, his father's talking about all this information you're soon going to find out about Hillary Clinton. They still think that just doesn't make sense. The notion that he said yesterday that his father, as far as he knows, you know, he doesn't know anything about his involvement in crafting that statement. Again, you know, you would think that this would be a pretty important thing going on in Donald Trump Jr.'s life, is that statement about what he did and didn't talk about, and then the fact that he wouldn't know whether his own father was involved in crafting the statement about it. So they, in a way, they almost went easy on him, it sounds like, in that closed session, because they want him to come back. And they want him to be willing to come back sometime by the end of the month. And they think that that's possible, to have to endure a public hearing when he didn't even want to be seen on Capitol Hill. He basically had, you know, sort of an escape route out of that meeting so that none of us ever laid eyes on him.
Of course, the news also this week, Facebook saying that they now see that Russian agents bought $100,000 worth or so of placement of ads and news, maybe fake news or targeted messages on Facebook in that campaign. Josh Gerstein, is that a big deal? $100,000 sounds like chump change in presidential election terms.
It is, I think, relatively speaking, chump change, but it is apparently illegal. Foreigners aren't supposed to be spending money to influence U.S. elections, but it does raise some intriguing questions, which is, did the Russian agents or the Russian individuals, supporters of the Russian government who apparently placed these online ads, have any assistance from anyone in targeting them? Were they just sort of guessing about where, which battleground states and which places these kinds of messages should be directed or to which audiences and on which issues they should be directed? Or did they have help from some Americans in doing that kind of targeting? And if they did have that help, were they Americans working in any way with the Trump campaign? That's what's so intriguing to both investigators on the Hill and, we think, to those working with special counsel Robert Mueller.
Big, big pile of news this week, and our thoughts in every minute with those in the Caribbean and now Florida as they brace for Hurricane Irma. Still kind of agog, Jack, at this Equifax. 143 million Americans with Social Security numbers and addresses and all kinds of stuff exposed. We have links at our site to what they say is whatever help they can give you if you fear you may have been one of them. Jack, are your millions threatened today, Jack?
I'm going to have to look into that.
Lock up Fort Knox. Who knows where it's going? I want to thank all three of you for being with us. Nancy Cordes, Chief Congressional Correspondent for CBS News. Thank you very much for being here, Nancy.
So great to be with you.
Josh Gerstein, Senior White House Reporter for Politico. Thank you, Josh.
Happy to join you. Stay safe.
And Jack, lock it down. Florida, stay safe. Thank you, everybody, for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.